With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello. It's season two. It's here. And today, we're talking about the Romans. I want this episode to act as the thread between Season 1's narrative and Season 2. I'll admit, I believe the Romans in Britain are a little overblown in their importance. I'm not sure they fundamentally change social structures or British culture. That said, that doesn't mean that the Romans weren't important at all. The Roman period was a unique time in British history, which is undeniably fascinating. The time of Roman occupation did change Britain, and I think there are four key ways in which the Romans have a direct influence on our story. Number one, while Rome didn't fundamentally change day-to-day life for most Brits, they did change the nature of infrastructure. The Romans created the first true towns in Britain. They created many of the major routeways, and especially in the north of Roman rule in Britain, the military infrastructure of Hadrian's Wall and supporting forts changed the landscape in dramatic fashion. Number two, Rome acted as a point of differentiation during the turbulent 400s. As Eastern Britain became Germanic and pagan, Western Britain began to become self-consciously Roman in an extreme way. One of the ways that Rome was inarguably revolutionary to British history is that, starting way before the Romans even arrived, Rome becomes a reference point to highlight just how cultured you are. In the Iron Age, Roman coins were issued by elites keen to demonstrate their power and influence. During Roman times, those who wanted to be seen as more elite adopted more Roman styles of doing things. In the immediately post-Roman period, Britons will become more Roman and Christian to distinguish themselves from the barbarians arriving on their eastern shore. This is a process that continues today. Even yours truly has been mocked on multiple times by people who sound far posher than me because of my complete lack of Latin. It's a silly example, but another silly example is the neoclassical style that is so popular by elites. What is that still today but a self-conscious attempt to seem Greco-Roman and therefore cultured? Number three, in a similar but more Germanic vein, from the 600s onwards, Anglo-Saxon elites will begin to ape their continental brethren. These elites will look to Francia and Rome for inspiration as to how to differentiate themselves from the ordinary people. A big part of that will be the adoration for all things Roman. Obviously, the Roman form of Christianity will explode in importance, and we'll see elites in later centuries magnifying any existing Roman reign still present in Britain. Number four, speaking of Roman Christianity, this is one of those places where I think direct over Roman influence on Britain is overblown. I'm not convinced by the narrative that most Britons were Christian during the late Roman period. However, the Roman Church will return to what is now England during our narrative and will have a massive effect on every aspect of society. For all these reasons, we need to discuss the Romans. But who were the Romans and what was Romanization? I wish they were easy questions. Let's start with the slightly easier one. Who were the Romans? Most of them didn't come from Rome, that's for sure. Oh sure, when the Romans invaded Britain, their leaders were all from old Roman families and many of the soldiers spoke Latin, but by the time we reached the end of Roman Britain, Rome really wasn't Roman anymore. By the time the 300s roll around and the Emperor Diocletian has brought a degree of stability to the empire, the Roman Empire is dominated by its provinces. Rome itself had become something of a backwater, symbolically important, but pragmatically too far out of the way to be of much use. The Romans, who traded in Britain or made up the army, were as likely to be African, Eastern European, Gaulish or Spanish as they were to be Italian, and true Romans from Rome were in the minority. The people who built the villas and forums of British cities were native Britons. Which brings us on to the tricky concept of Romanitas, or Romanization. You see, Rome's success was founded on its ability to be flexible. When their military stopped being successful, they changed it. When they recognised the Republic wasn't coming back, they ditched their hatred of kings for the Empire. One of the ways the Roman Empire displayed this flexibility of thinking was their approach to the definition of Roman. Being Roman meant being a Roman citizen, and in 212, Caracalla, one of Rome's cruelest and weakest emperors, announced that all free men in the Roman Empire were Roman citizens. This was the final point on a conceptual journey Rome had been taking since the social wars 300 years before Caracalla's pronouncements. This journey started with the Romans having a geographical definition of citizenship. However, once the Romans had granted full citizenship to the neighbouring tribes, they started a process where citizenship stopped being about where you are from, but by how you act. Roman stopped being a national term and instead was a cultural identity. This made Roman a much more nebulous, fluffy word, which archaeologists and historians have been arguing about since a chap called Haverfield in 1912 argued that Romanitas, the act of being a Roman, was associated with things like big countryside estates with well-proportioned towns and cities with stone buildings alongside international trade and a healthy dose of militarism, or a Greco-Roman version of the late British Empire. Many academics still subscribe to Haverfield's arguments, but this isn't a literature review, so I won't break open that debate. Instead, what we're going to see this episode is that things are a lot more complex than what Haverfield proposed. People have a lot more to say about their identity than imperialists would like to think, and we will see that while there definitely was a Roman culture in Britain, it was much more Romano-British than Roman. Identity was flexible, and the status and power of Romanitas was adopted and interpreted by all sorts of folks for their own personal ends. London, as so often throughout history, is a mirror to the fortunes of Britain, which is why it'll be our primary focus. While Britain is outward-looking and centralised, London booms. As Britain becomes more fractured and insular, London declines. And that's as true today as it was back then. We're about to have the brief musical interlude before we give a rapid run-through of the Roman occupation of Britain, but something lovely took place the other day, and I want to tell you all what happened. Many of you will know of my deep and abiding love for Channel 4's excellent archaeology programme, Time Team, which ran with barely ever a poor episode for 20 years between 1994 and 2014. Those last few seasons were often hosted by Mariana Chotter, who has gone on to write several great books about archaeology and the British landscape. Her book, Hidden Histories, is one I often thrust into the hand of friends when they ask about archaeology. We follow each other on Instagram, which is awesome enough, but the other day she dropped me a message to offer to send me a book. Her new book. And it's arrived, and I've done a pretty thorough flick through, and well, it's excellent. The book is jam-packed with 2 or 3 page introductions to some of Britain's best sites. It has filled me with ideas, and the photography is first class. I've not been paid to say this, all she's done is send me a book. She asked me first, and I said yes, and to thank her, I said I'd mention it on the show and on my socials. So, thank you, Marianne, for keeping the flame of popular archaeology alight and writing books that show how marvellously full of the past the British landscape is. Anyway, let's get on with the show. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and finally, welcome to the first episode of Season 2 of this, All Bones. This is not a podcast interested in telling large-scale political narratives. I'm less interested in what happened and more about why things happened. Humans, especially the leaders of human societies, are rarely more than flotsam on the waves of multi-generational shifts such as climate change and the million tiny actions that make up cultural development. However, I think that if we're to keep this discussion of the Romans to one episode, we need to split this episode into two unequal parts. The first, shorter part, is a brief rampage through the Roman history of Britain. This will be ludicrously simplified, but we'll contextualise the second, much larger part of today's show, where we discuss how life changed in Roman Britain through the lens of the most Roman, most continental and least British part of this island, London. London is for later, though. What I'm about to do is give you the 30,000 feet view of what happened over the traditional 464 years of direct interference in Britain by the Romans. Please note, before we begin though, that almost everything I'm about to tell you could be disagreed with. The first Romans to arrive in Britain would have been traders, but Romans thought they weren't worthy of historical attention, and so the first we hear of Romans visiting Britain was when Julius Caesar made the unwise decision to visit Britain for his summer holidays in 55 and 54 BCE. That didn't go very well, mostly because, like most British summers, the weather was terrible. However, Julius Caesar wasn't visiting for any purpose beyond his own self-aggrandizement. If he wanted, Julius Caesar could have conquered this island. There has never been a greater campaign general than Caesar. He didn't just take new land, he held new land. However, like most great generals, the thing Caesar loved most in the world was Caesar, and so in doing the unthinkable and visiting the strange semi-mythical islands of Britannia was enough for Caesar. And so, seeing all the rain and fog, he left. 90 years later came Claudius, who was the grandnephew of Caesar's nephew, Augustus, who was the first emperor. Claudius had become emperor because he was the least threatening man in Rome. His predecessor was the first of the Roman Empire's true tyrants, the cutely named but vicious Caligula, whose nickname meant Little Boots because of how cute a kid he was. Caligula had been toying with the idea of invading Britain before being stabbed to death. Claudius was then chosen as emperor because he was placid, academic, and just the exact opposite of Caligula. However, that meant people didn't really respect Claudius. In the history of the Roman Empire, if you were in need of respect or legitimacy, one of the favourite methods was to do something which Caesar hadn't. Caesar was the great, the MVP, and so if you could better Caesar, then kudos. So, Claudius decided not just to invade Britain, but to conquer the island. This wasn't as easy as the Romans expected. Caesar had conquered Gaul in 8 years, and after his conquest, Gaul was as peaceful as the Roman Empire ever was. Britannia is roughly half the size of Gaul, and yet, 20 years after the Romans first invaded, they barely got to modern-day Wales. This was because of Britain's terrible weather when compared with the Mediterranean, the difficulty of shipping supplies across the English Channel, and because British people really like fighting. This is a theme across British history from now on. We're a violent people. As Hilary Mantel says in Wolf Hall, quote, "The British will never be forgiven for the talent for destruction they have always displayed when they get off their own island." End quote. Unfortunately for the Romans, we didn't have to leave our island to display that talent for destruction. In 60 CE, an understandably upset Boudicca explodes onto the scene. I won't get into the Roman reasons for how they acted, but it is enough to say the Romans, because they thought they were in charge, invaded Boudicca's land after the death of her husband, the chief. We all know that Celts were quite happy to let women rule, but the Romans turned misogyny into an art form, and so crushed this hint of independence and female vitality by burning Boudicca's lands, flogging her, and raping her daughters. This has been historically described as a bad move. To keep this short, Boudicca raised an army and set fire to the southeast of England. Quite literally. She sacked Colchester, at the time the Roman capital in Britannia. She also burnt London down, and I think she cursed London by that burning, because after this point, London burns down a lot. The Romans realised that maybe they'd made a mistake. The thing is, though, the mistake the Romans thought they'd made was that they'd not been violent enough, and so outside modern-day St. Albans, they defeated Boudicca's army, slaughtered everyone they could find, but it still took them another 20 years to get the southern half of Britain under any sort of control. Even then, it took over another 100 years or so before the Romans finally gave up. Emperor Hadrian visited the island in 122 CE, and as part of his entrenchment of the whole empire, ordered the first border wall to be built between Newcastle and Carlisle. Hadrian's Wall still stands, and Binchester, the Roman fort I learnt to dig at, which we mentioned a few times during the specials, was one of the many forts supporting that fortification. A few emperors, most notably Septimius Severus, attempted to subdue the Britons north of Hadrian's Walls. These attempts, in a word, failed. However, some gains were made early on, enough for a further wall to be built between modern-day Edinburgh and Glasgow. This wall lasted from 142 to 150 CE, a grand total of 8 years. This is the furthest north the Roman Empire ever got, and to be fair to them, North Britain, most of which is modern-day Scotland, is a hard nut to crack, with a hilly, rocky landscape well-suited to defence and with little economic potential in a grain-based society. During this first phase of Roman rule, Britain was an urbanised country, as urbanised as it ever would be until the early modern period. This was the truly revolutionary period of Roman rule, when Rome had the most direct effect on Britain, and much of what we think of as Roman Britain comes from this first phase. However, the Antonine Plague arrived around 175 CE. This plague is what killed Marcus Antonius, the nice emperor at the beginning of Gladiator. This plague was massively disruptive to the Roman political and economic system, which was nearly 200 years old and beginning to show its age. This led to a shift in Britain, which we'll see when we discuss Roman London. Towns and cities became less populous, and we see the rise of two important Roman settlement types, villas and vici. Essentially, after the Antonine Plague, things get a bit unsteady for the Roman Empire. It's so bad we call this the crisis of the 3rd century. During this 50-year period, there were 26 emperors. That is an emperor being replaced, usually violently, more often than major US elections. I don't want to lay out everything that happened during this period. There's actually a series by Extra History about this period, which is a great source to find out more. However, I have to stress just how vital this period is to the Western Roman Empire. In French Roman studies, this crisis is the dividing line between the two styles of Roman occupation they recognise in their archaeological record. I think it's fair to say that this is the vital dividing line in Roman Britain too. Prior to the crisis of the 3rd century, the Roman emperor was all-powerful, but aimed to appear as little more than a first citizen. The interior of the empire was mostly peaceful, the Pax Romana you often hear referenced in more modern contexts. The empire was highly integrated and prosperous. The crisis of the 3rd century caused massive economic displacement and led, under the Emperor Diocletian, to an increased regionalisation of the empire and eventually the rise of an honorary Yorkshireman as emperor, Constantine the Great, a Serbian by birth who was acclaimed emperor in York in 306 CE. The Emperor
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
As you followed Diocletian and Constantine, were far more uncertain in their position, which is understandable after a score of their predecessors had been murdered, most within living memory. Emperors of the late Roman Empire became far more Byzantine in style. They were more disconnected from public life and sat at the centre of a far more glorious court than anything that followed the Augustinian model. However, that glory tried and failed to hide a fundamental fragility and decentralisation of Roman power. This 130-year or so period we've just described is the so-called middle period of the Roman occupation of Britain. As you can imagine, the collapse in the centre of society had ripples which hit local centres the hardest. This is one of the primary reasons for the shift in Roman Britain from the towns to villas and vici, which I'll call ruralisation. There were other reasons for that ruralisation. The Roman provinces became more peaceful, making it safer for Roman elites to live outside of towns. Also, during the early phase of Roman occupation, Britain was producing and exporting very little. Once the region was pacified, Britain began to export goods like tin, fish, gold, salt, copper, and crops. All of these were what prompted the development of villas, which allowed those who owned the means of production to live closer to where their goods were being produced, improving the management of Britain's countryside. The Vichy developed for slightly different, initially contradictory reasons. Britain was never a peaceful place by Roman standards. Gaul, a good comparison, was almost entirely demilitarised, save for its border regions. Britain, though, whilst being peaceful in the southeast, was highly militarised in the north and west. With four legions stationed permanently, Britain probably had the highest proportion of troops when compared to the population of any Roman province, and most of them were in the north. Save for York, there were few large civilian trading settlements in these more militarised regions, and also, as far as we can tell, far fewer villas. Instead of villas and towns, you had forts like Binchester, but also more famously, Burd Oswald and Vindolanda on Hadrian's Wall. These forts acted a little like villas in the more peaceful south. They were areas of economic accretion where traders and farmers would come and sell their wares. Vichy, which are the settlements that popped up around these towns, also provided many services to the soldiers in the forts, and that relationship became very important as centralised Roman control began to crumble during the end of the Roman period. So, during the middle phase, there were destabilising factors, pushing people, especially elites and merchants, out of towns. There were also pull factors, including greater economic opportunity, encouraging those same people to move into the countryside towards places like villas and Vichy. The final period runs roughly from the acclamation of Constantine to 410 CE, when the elites in Britain were given official notice by the Emperor Honorius that they had to help themselves. This period has been argued by some to be the peak of Roman civilization in Britain. Many of the same themes continued from the middle period. Villas continued to grow, and military forts became a fixed, central part of the North Romano-British landscape, with permanent garrisons and bustling Vichy. However, there were two other major themes during this period. Christianity and pirates. After Constantine, Rome became a Christian empire. If you wanted to have any sort of status in this new world, you had to worship Jesus Christ and abandon the pagan gods of your forefathers. The Christianization of Roman Britain is complicated. I won't get too into it here, but know that the empire was now officially Christian, but this doesn't always come through very strongly in the archaeological record, suggesting people were acting Christian in public, but remaining pagan in private. The post-Constantine order was stable and profitable. On the surface, Rome's glory returned in the 300s. Diocletian's reforms and the new Christian religion seemed to be the innovations necessary to breathe new life into the empire. However, the crisis of the 3rd century had ended the myth of Roman invincibility. Beyond the Rhine and Danube, raiders gathered into bands, and sometimes those bands, for many fascinating reasons, became vast armies that spilled across the border. Sometimes they were thrown back. Sometimes they were allowed to settle, and sometimes, led by men like Alaric the Great, they sacked and devastated much of the empire, including Rome itself in 410 CE, the same year Rome gave up on Britain. Speaking of Britain, the island was far from immune to the disruption. It is during the 300s that we begin to see references to Saxons in the historical record. Most famously, in 367, Franks, Saxons, Picts, and Irish Scots invaded Roman Britain in the Great Barbarian Conspiracy. This lasted a year and was only ended when Theodosius the Elder devastated the barbarian armies. Theodosian's son was Theodosius the Great, the last ruler of a united Roman Empire. Romano-British involvement in the Barbarian Conspiracy suggests some of the British tried to harness these raiders to their own advantage. This introduced many of the Germanic tribes, like the Saxons, to the fact that Britain was rich, isolated land, which Rome struggled to hold at the best of times. Why did the Britons get involved in this? Well, I think this shows how many in Britain were becoming disillusioned with Roman rule. Oh yes, they still liked much of the culture, but even that was beginning to wear thin, representing, as it did, a continued failure to maintain Britain in the way to which it had become accustomed. By this point, Britain, like other provinces, was paying for the joy of having an occupying army. Unfortunately, while this worked for regions closer to the centre, which could rely on other provinces or the Roman armies under the Emperor's command, Britain was on its own and paying to defend the Roman Empire from people trying to get in. At some point, Britain got frustrated. The elites wanted more support, more influence, and more security. The Empire couldn't offer that anymore, and so they tried to go with a usurper. Unfortunately, the Barbarian Conspiracy was simply the best documented of raids. These raids continued throughout the Western Roman Empire, forcing the Roman Emperor to pull troops from Britain to protect richer parts of the Empire. Eventually, in 410, the British elite begged the Emperor Honorius to return some of the troops to help protect themselves from continued raids. He refused, and whilst that might not have been the end of Roman interest in Britain, it was the effective end of centralised Roman control of the island. When the Romans left, so did Latin, leaving a paltry 800 words in the lexicon of ancient British languages. Christianity, formal Christianity at any rate, left what would become England for nearly two centuries. Within a century, most of what had been Roman Britain would be Germanic in culture, and the only people who still remembered Roman Britain fondly would be those in modern-day Wales and Cornwall, who had existed on the very edges of the Roman Empire, where Roman rule was weakest. We'll explore their memorialisation of Romanitas in future episodes. And that is about as brief a summary of Roman Britain as I think it's possible to provide. If all of that gives you a taste for more Romans, then you need to do two things. One, listen to The History of Rome by Mike Duncan. This is unquestionably the greatest historical podcast ever. It is to history podcasts what Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band is to pop music. Number two, listen to the British History Podcast. The pure focus on Britain and Jamie's greater willingness to use archaeological material makes the show a good bridge between this episode and Mike Duncan's larger narrative. You should also read Gibbon, Tom Holland, and Mary Beard because they are, in my opinion, the most entertaining historians of this period. That's right, Edward Gibbon, the guy from the 18th century. No one matches him for sheer bitchiness. But all that talk of history has exhausted me. Let's take a short break. I'll grab a coffee, and if I was more avaricious, you might have been hearing an ad right now. Thanks be to Patreon that you're not. When I'm back, we'll take a more archaeological turn. See you in a sec. The river is wide and greeny brown. You stand on the deck of a ship, eyes painted on its brow, square sail tied tight around the main mast. And either side of you, burly armed rowers heave you up the river on the incoming tide. The river has been carved into small, white waves by the speed of the ship. The captain paces nervously. The oars are wide and the bridge's pillars are large but unavoidably narrow. He'd spoken previously about the tricky manoeuvre to build up enough speed to get through the bridge while giving yourself enough time to draw in the oars. There was a sense of serious concentration, and so you focus on soaking up the view. Ahead looms the large walls of Londinium. They cover the north side of the river and are so vast they stretch far beyond your eyesight. Crossing the river is the bridge with vast stone pillars. And south of the river, where the bridge connected, the walls continued around a small island, bustling with activity. The road which runs parallel to the river is flanked with mausoleums, blue-grey wisps of smoke curling from the offerings left by the families of the deceased. You can't see more, but you feel to your side, to the small leather bag you carry on your belt, to check for the thousandth time that your precious cargo is still in place. You look up as the boat floats beneath the bridge and the sailors hold a collective breath. The stones are neatly laid and the arches soar above your eyes. And then the bridge passes over and you squint as the sun, pale and hazy behind the high clouds, comes back into view. You look down, back to the water, towards the north side of the river, and you see the boat's final destination. The harbour, cut into the bank and overseen by the vast government house surrounded by colonnades. The oarsmen heave and the boat turns, small waves crashing against the side as the rudder fights the tide. There is shouting from the boat to the men waiting on the dock. On the dockside stand soldiers and officious men holding boards and wearing "don't mess with me" looks. Letting the noise wash over you, you gaze up at the palace. From the river it looks impossibly tall, the marble bright and shining white despite the weak sun. As the boat is pushed and tugged closer to port, the palace only gets larger and larger. The walls are impassive, telling nothing of what is going on within. Then you feel a jolt and glance at the quayside. The boat is docked and you've been told to get off of the boat. You jump onto the gangplank, slip the officious-looking man a few gold and a slap on the back and head towards the busy street. The path towards the main street runs uphill, along the east side of the palace, which is as gargantuan and threatening from the street as it is from the river. At the top of the hill, you catch a whiff of something delicious and turn onto the roar of the main road, heading towards the forum. The street is riotous, filled with carts and people walking back and forth, stopping in the street, barging past and getting to who knows where. Along the road, stores are open to the streets, with people shouting from the stories above. A smudge is in the sky from across the river, where much industry is taking place. You keep walking before turning left, dancing past carts, down a quieter lane you know well. You turn right soon after, popping out onto another thunderous thoroughfare. You turn left again and into the forum. The forum strikes you yet again with its sheer vastness. It's bigger than any you've ever seen. A huge open space, the grey stone mirroring the pale grey skies above you. Around the outside, using the colonnade as a backdrop, a stall after stall. They are selling anything anyone could ever want. There are wine sellers, grain sellers, meat sellers, vegetable sellers, cloth merchants, jewel merchants, weapon merchants, mosaic specialists, and behind them, in the colonnades, are tutors threatening education to the brains of the richer kids. It's a sight to strike wonder into the eyes of the naive. But you've been here before, and are undisturbed by Londinium's noise or splendour. You've got a job to do. You head to some familiar faces. One is selling grain, of which you buy a small bag. The other is selling wine, of which you buy a couple of bottles. You exchange pleasantries with both. The conversation is brief. For once, there is little to report beyond Londinium's habitual busyness. You turn back to the main road. You retrace your steps, pausing for a second to admire the palace building once again. This time, you're able to see the front, guarded by vast columns and soldiers with thick rectangular shields. It's a lovely building, vast in its officialdom. You keep walking and find yourself following a group of soldiers who are chatting in a way that suggests that, despite their armour and swords, they're not really on duty. Well, not official duty. Instead, they amble for a few hundred yards before turning right up a narrow path. You glance up at it, but you know what's up there already. It's the Mithraeum, the temple of one of those eastern gods that had developed such followings in the recent years. You've got your own gods to visit. You walk out of the city, past the gates and down the main road. The road to the west of the city is lined with shrines and mausolea. You edge your way through the forest of marble monuments until you reach a small shrine. It's a few feet high, with two carved figures holding up a portico. In front of this small monument, you kneel. You pour one of the bottles of wine into the soil, and then take the grain, pour it into the small brass bowl in front of the shrine. From the small leather pouch at your side, you remove a small blue glass bottle and empty its contents into the bowl with the grain. It smells wonderful, and you leave the bottle at the base of the shrine. You strike a flint until the grain catches and begins to burn, giving out its soft blue smoke. You pop open your own bottle of wine and sit on the ground. Jupiter bless you, Mother, Father. Thank you for your protection on my journey. Let me tell you what I saw. So that is a high-level introduction to Londinium and the most Roman place of Roman Britain. I wanted to take you through the main things to see in Roman London and suggest to you what someone might have seen and how they might have used the cemeteries that surrounded Londinium. We walked through classical Roman London, the richest and grandest period of this city, when the cemeteries were at their peak. We're going to bookend this episode with a brief look at someone who lived in another city, Eboracum or York, at the very end of the Roman period, but that's for a little while still. But this season isn't about the Romans. I don't want to break the story down you just heard to explain all the small bits and interesting details. No, instead I want to talk about the impact of Rome on Britain. We'll explore first the good things Rome gave to Britain, the things that made daily life better for most folk. We'll then shift and spend some time discussing what was bad about life under the Romans. Then finally, the things which are kind of neither good nor bad. At the end, I'll try and capture all of that with an actual archaeological case study, which, as I said, is about someone who lived in late Roman York. But first, the good things about Rome. I think there are two things we can definitely identify. The diversity of Roman Britain and the economic benefits brought to Roman Britain. First, diversity. I think one of the more pervasive myths about the Roman Empire is that Roman was a fixed identity. This is why we spent all that time in the introduction talking about Roman and Romanitas. The Roman identity is a complex topic, which honestly, I think is an area that's really understudied still, or at least isn't so well studied that it's routinely affecting the interpretation seen in less theoretical journeys, which I've tried to stick to for this episode. The way the Romans ruled their empire, very simply, was to insert themselves at the top of the tree, but leave everything else in place and let the process of Romanitization happen organically. This gives the empire a patchwork character. Gaul, for example, was almost more Roman than Italy, as was Greece, and it isn't a surprise that the Holy Roman Empire and the Byzantine Empire developed in those very Roman regions. Britain, though, remained as its own little patchwork patch in the wider patchwork quilt which we've just described. And what that patchwork patch looked like was essentially four major areas, which the Romans themselves recognised by in the 300s, dividing Britain from two provinces into four. The first and most important, Romanly speaking, was the southeast. We'd call this southern England, and it includes much of what is now southwest England and the Midlands, as well as the southeast we think of today as the southeast. Capiche? This was the most Roman part of Britain. It was the first place to be conquered. It had many towns, large and small, places like London, Canterbury, St. Albans, Bath, Lincoln, Colchester, Silchester, Exeter, Wroxeter, Porchester, and many, many, many more. These were the cities like the one we walked through just now. They were stone-built with markets, well-made roads, theatres, amphitheatres, they are different, strong walls and administrative buildings. This was also the land of the villa, and where you didn't have many towns, especially on the hills, on land suitable for sheep and wheat, Britain is blessed with many great villas. We met one last month at Chedwood in the Cotswolds, but Oxfordshire and Gloucestershire are littered with the things, as is much of the southeast. The cities brought wealth, and the villas were the expression of all that money in private, privileged luxury. In the north, it is a much more heavily militarized zone, although some research is beginning to show that there was a greater elite civilian population. It was the first thing the legionaries created when they stopped their marching every night. When they started a siege, up went the forts, and when a place was conquered, the forts were built to show that the place had been conquered, and to ensure that the same place stayed conquered. Also, in places like northern Britain, where the Romans founded few towns, the forts acted as a stone-built reminder that everything, the geography, the roads and the economy, all served the military. They were positioned in dominant places in the landscape, and they acted as centres for all the locals to bring their commerce and to found their own towns, called Vici, around the fort itself. When Rome couldn't turn the elite onto Rome willingly, like in southern Britain, they turned the population onto Rome forcefully, using their forts, and they are the dominant feature of the northern British Roman landscape. The other two regions were created to recognise that in the west, what is now Wales and Britain's southwest, Roman control was substantially different from Roman control on the eastern side of Britain. There are few forts and fewer towns. Instead, these regions were only visited by the occasional Roman legion ensuring peace, and the far more common entrepreneurs who made vast sums of money extracting the material wealth of Wales and Cornwall and shipping it to the continent. We can combine these two provinces into the Roman West because although they were two provinces, there weren't the same dramatic differences between them as there were between the West, the North and the South East. Instead, those two provinces are more of a recognition of a geographical reality rather than a political, demographic or economic reality. Why is all of this good? Well, not to damn with faint praise, but Rome didn't disrupt Britain's economy or political situation any more than they needed. The North and West, where the tougher geography and greater historical separation between those regions and the continent, made those regions less enamoured with Romanitas, harder to conquer and riskier to rule. Rome focused there on keeping as light a hand as possible, and you get the impression they were focused on extracting wealth from those regions and hoping they would just not cause too much trouble. By not fundamentally upsetting Britain's balance, Rome maintained a sense of identity that led to the diversity of developments we see in Britain right up until today. Probably the most salient one for this series is the relationship the different regions had with Christianity. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that Christianity didn't penetrate as deeply into the more rural areas of Britain like the North and West. In the West, out of the way from Germanic settlers, that didn't mean much. Indeed, it meant that they created new forms of Christianity to differentiate themselves from their new German neighbours. However, in the North of England, Christianity disappeared very quickly, probably because it wasn't as well established as in the South, where bubbles of Christianity were never properly popped and were still present, if theologically distorted, when St. Augustine arrived. The religious effect of Rome, as well as the form and intensity of Roman control, also led to different forms of government and political control, which is basically what the rest of the series is going to explore. However, those effects, which led to kingdoms as different as continental Kent in the southeast, in the region which actively welcomed Rome, versus the forever troublesome Northumberland, which was never demilitarised or pacified by Rome, and predictably was the least comfortable with the idea of a unified England. Come to think of it, the land north of the Humber is still the region most uncomfortable with the idea of unified England, except for, you know, Cornwall. These social developments that have their roots in the Iron Age have also created vastly different regions in Britain, which are so distinct that in DNA tests, people can be accurately identified as being from the northeast or from Yorkshire or from the southeast. The people themselves are different. However, all this means that Britain, like Dacia in Eastern Europe, was never a proper Roman province. It always had a whiff of the barbarian about it, and it is not surprising that it is one of the first regions to leave the empire when trouble arose in the late 300s. That said, the maintenance of diversity, settling for a pragmatic, stable form of rule, allowed Rome to focus on what really mattered to them, some of which benefited Britain. For example, the Romans made Britain's economy far more efficient, organised, and globalised. There is a farm in the east of England called Great Holt's Farm. It lies near Boreham in Essex, not far from Colchester, the original capital of Roman Britain, and forever since an important town which connected Essex to the continent and made the region rich. We can see a lot of what Rome gave to those, especially those in the southeastern province, at this farm. The farm dates to the 200s and 300s, a time that Guy de la Bedière, of Time Team fame, considers the golden age of Roman Britain. Great Holt's Farm is an example of the adage that a rising tide lifts all boats, because this is not necessarily a rich farm. The land isn't brilliant. The farmhouse itself is a plain building, but its inhabitants were clearly on the make. The farm lies on heavy clay, soils too heavy to be farmed by native means. The connection with the continent gave this family access to larger cows from Italy, strong enough to pull a plough, tough enough to break open these hard but potentially fertile soils. These newly tilled soils were sown with grain, which was then processed and stored on site, not necessarily for consumption at the farm itself. No, these folks were making so much grain that it lay at the heart of a business that really began to boom within the boundaries of Roman rule. Some of the grain they grew fed their animals, which were worked until they were old before being eaten. No doubt, they were also bred and with some used to plough the land and with others being sold for meat or stud. Some of the grain was malted, making it ideal for rich, sweet bread or bright, tasty beer. All of these added value products would have been a higher margin addition to the main business of selling lots and lots of grain to the bakers in the towns. This might not seem that incredible, but we don't have a lot of evidence for self-sufficiency at Great Holt's Farm. Instead, what we have is evidence of a specialised market economy and people benefiting as a result. The family of Great Holt's Farm made a lot of money selling grain. Enough money that they could buy food from Britain, Gaul and beyond. High quality, high status and more diverse foods like olives and Spanish mackerel, as well as preserved fish like scad from the Mediterranean and never eaten in Britain before the Romans arrived. There is also evidence they were beginning to express a more elite identity by taking part in hawking, although this might have been an elite activity that also had the added advantage of keeping the pests at bay. The family at Great Holt's Farm, like many in Essex throughout history, were a family on the make. Their lives were getting better, their style gaudier, and their activities more and more elite. This could only happen because of the globalised economy that developed under the auspices of Rome. The globalised economy was organised, efficient and integrated, allowing people to get really good at a small number of things. As we've seen since the start of the Industrial Revolution, increased specialisation increases output and reduces prices while simultaneously increasing profit margins. Undoubtedly, for those able to take advantage, the integration into the continental system ruled by Rome was a massive opportunity, and many Britons got rich and fat because of Rome. The Roman Empire was an empire. I think we've all got this image of the Romans as marvellous, urbane and glorious, spreading civilization into the world and pushing back barbarism. Surprise, surprise, That's a view that has been pushed relentlessly since the early modern period, a time when Europeans were heading out into the world to spread civilization and push back barbarism. I hope I don't need to tell you that imperialism is always exploitative. No matter whether you think empires can be on balance for good or that it's always evil, I think we can agree that empires are fundamentally exploitative. That's the reason they exist. The Roman Empire is no different. Britain was a little bit like the Roman equivalent of South Africa for the British Empire. Stick with me here. South Africa was acquired by the British to protect important sea lanes and to demonstrate Britain's political and military might over the Dutch and the French, their closest rivals. Under British control, the southern tip was developed with cities and the rule of British law was established. However, much of the value of South Africa to the empire soon stopped being simply a valuable and glorious port. Instead, beyond Cape Town, South Africa was pretty much one giant larder for British industrialists to break into and pillage. Diamonds, gold, iron, and many more resources were shipped from South Africa, and the supposed benefits of British rule never spread beyond Cape Town, really. When the British left, they left a people who had gotten used to being exploited and suffered the health consequences as such. Into the vacuum of British rule flooded mismanagement, misrule, and violence. The same is true of Roman Britain. There's a reason Welsh gold is very rare. The Romans took most of it. They took a lot of Cornwall's tin too, and the North salt, and jet, and limestone, and wool, and all the other material wealth which blesses this island. British people got precipitously shorter underneath Roman control, only regaining Iron Age levels of height in the early medieval period, before losing it again when the Normans took control. Much of this exploitation was done by Britain's native elites on Rome's behalf. It's here that we reach the rocky waters of Romanitas. Was it a thing, or just a way to conflate British imperialism with something cool and Roman? Well, that's a tough and ongoing debate. What is definite is that the people who took to the new Roman way of life were the existing elites, especially those in the southern half of what is now England. This is most famously visible at Fishbourne Palace, the largest villa in Britain, and built by a one Togidubnus, which is a very Celtic name. His home is the most outlandish example of a Brit embracing their new rulers with open arms, big smiles, and soon, piles and piles of shining denarii. Rome was a far more hierarchical society than Iron Age Britain. Oh yeah, the Britons had rulers, often very powerful, very violent men. However, the more localised economy limited their power and the opportunities for conspicuous consumption, leaving them closer to the common masses and so much more likely to, you know, listen to what the people wanted or needed. With Roman wealth and Roman legions, that didn't need to happen, and the British elites very often did much of the colonising for the Romans by building big rural estates, sponsoring urban buildings in places like Londinium, and forcing their erstwhile subjects into the role of Roman peasantry, which wasn't a nice place to be. All of this happened because Roman control knitted Britain into the continental system. You might be able to argue that during the 100s and early 300s, this gave Britain many of the benefits which we just discussed, but it is undoubtable that these also had many negative effects. These include the increased hierarchy, the greater inequality that made most people physically shorter, a sure sign of people having shorter, unhealthier lives from the moment they were born. Life got harder for most people under Rome. The hierarchy also relied on the Roman state for survival. Britain, as I say, was knitted into the continental system. Not only did Britain pay for this dubious privilege by selling the island's mineral wealth for cheap, but also because, as we're seeing at the moment, the more integrated a system is, the more fragile the whole system is to shocks in a single part of the network. Britain's elite seemed to struggle to maintain control of the island when centralised control was lost, and it took until the House of Wessex began to exert consistent domination in the 900s, 500 years after the Romans left, that ex-Roman Britain was in an economic and political situation where it could begin to operate as a unified system again. That's because, for Britain, on the extremities of the empire, the system was too complex, the understanding of economics too non-existent, for it to benefit consistently from the complex system it was forced into at the point of a gladius. Rome and Roman rule isn't simple. Like, when you look at the late stage British Empire from the 1850s onwards, most commentators, even men like Niall Ferguson, agree that it was a bad thing due to widespread exploitation and human rights abuses. The Roman Empire became less exploitative and less abusive over time. However, all empire is exploitative, and the giant ball of wealth and safety that was the Western Empire made all the regions of the Western Empire exposed in the 300s when horsemen trampling across the Asian steppes set off a tsunami of Germanic migration westwards. However, I want to avoid talking about these large-scale generalities because, well, look at the length of the episode already. We need to get a shift on. Also, because it deserves its own podcast, like, well, the history of Rome. I think there are two gifts Rome gave to Britain which had a major effect on Britain's historic trajectory, but which had mixed results. These two presents, urbanisation and Christianity, find their ambivalent heritage in the ambivalent response to them from the native British population. Let's kick off with urbanisation. Romans brought town to Britons, well, towns in the modern sense. In the late Iron Age of southern Britain, there are sites called oppida that seem to be proto-urban, being centres of elite control, elite display and economic protection. However, they weren't towns. They lacked markets, utilities or large, dense populations. And I think a town needs to not just be defensively or ideologically powerful. It needs to be socially, economically and demographically vital to the region within which it exists for it to be called a town. As we explored in our opening story, Roman towns in Britain had it all. Big walls, palaces for the protection of booty, as well as the coordination and expression of political and ideological control. They had large markets, so many bathhouses, temples, relatively large populations, and importantly, populations that were distinct from the countryside. In the towns, you could find merchants, craftsmen, the unemployed, entertainers, including gladiators in the earlier periods, rich elites, students, teachers, all roles which weren't very common in late Iron Age Britain. Overall, this increase in opportunity and wealth has to be seen as a good thing. Towns in of themselves were beneficial. However, they only existed in a limited region of Britain, and while they didn't exactly disappear with the fall of Rome, late Roman and post-Roman towns from the mid-300s were decisively moving away from being classical towns and becoming something much closer in function to the oppida of late Iron Age Britain. It's clear that the Britons, including the elites, were apathetic towards urbanisation. Even regions like Wales, which had a town at Cardiff which retained a Roman vibe and Christianity, abandoned their towns when Rome left. It was one of those things which people seemed keen to ditch. Why? Well, I think the negative of towns is that they are vast sinkholes of resources. Not just material resources like food, wealth and building materials, but also less measurable resources like political capital and religious management. Roman towns survived on being both an economic and ideological focus for the surrounding region. They relied on the elites to both invest in the town's utilities and on those elites corralling the population into supplying the town. With both an increase in taxation under Diocletian and a drop in international trade due to increased raiding, the towns lost that economic importance. Elites shifted their money into their villas like Chedworth, which we visited last month. This allowed them to more effectively avoid the taxman. You can bet your bottom dollar that Trumpist Analdium would have had the most bigly of villas in the mid-300s CE. So, towns collapse as economic centres in any Roman sense of the world. I think that is indisputable. We see this quite visibly in the archaeological record. Across all the towns of Roman Britain, York and London included, there are huge patches of so-called dark earth in the stratigraphy. This dark earth is dark grey or black soil filled with ash and remnants of stone and brick. It's not a destruction layer, instead it's an abandonment layer. The dark earth represents previously inhabited regions being abandoned by urban activity. Instead, the buildings were left to crumble or were burnt for fire by the homeless of late Roman Britain. Those same areas may have also been used to graze or hold cattle, whose dung and mist feed makes up a large proportion of the soil we discover now. However, there is increasing evidence that the sites for towns shifted in function and took on a more natively British role. We see in many towns metalworking being done beneath the ruined walls of Roman Basilica, or large halls being built atop the cracked floors of a town's forum. This suggests that as towns decreased in economic importance, elites began to use them as centres to protect their assets, including the important metal workers, and to express a legitimising connection to the ancient Romans, men who would be remembered in folklore as giants capable of superhuman feats like engineering Hadrian's Wall. That's why urbanisation is an ambivalence. Britain actively chose, while still under Roman control, to shift their economic model away from towns. However, there is a clear effort to maintain either the towns themselves or the areas near to the towns as important ideological centres. It is these towns that often acted as the centre for urban resurgence at the beginning of the late Anglo-Saxon period, like Londonvic, the name for the town under what is now London Strand and East End, which was built up to and against the west wall of Londinium, but studiously avoided ever encroaching on the old Roman town. There is a similar story with Christianity, a story of broad abandonment plus an adaptation by some to legitimise a new social order. This is where dates are useful to explain what was happening, which is something you'll rarely hear me say. I think many people think of early Rome as pagan and then later Roman Empire as Christian, which is true, but that image doesn't map well onto Britain. Let's illustrate this. Christianity only became an accepted religion, an equally protected part of the empire's religious hodgepodge, in 311 CE under Constantine the Great. Christians were legally co-equal with pagans until 380 CE, when Theodosius the Great legalized the social reality that Christianity had become dominant among the elites in the Roman Empire. The Great Barbarian Conspiracy basically marks the start of the endgame for Roman Britain, and that was in 367, 13 years before Christianity became the state religion. Taking 410 as the end of Roman Britain gives us only 30 years, one generation, during which Britain was a supposedly Christian country. I don't think Britain was a properly Christian country when the Romans left. I believe that most folks outside of the towns were still pagan. And I think you can see this in the Pelagian heresy, which maybe isn't necessary to this podcast, but I love it, so we're talking about it. The Pelagian heresy stems from the term Pelagianism, which means the belief in the teachings of a chap called Pelagius. If any of you have seen the film King Arthur, the one where Keira Knightley played a half-naked, woad-covered version of Guinevere, Pelagius gets mentioned many times as a bit of a plot device. But Pelagius was a real person. He argued, essentially, that humans are not born sinful, but born as images of God, with an innate knowledge of right and wrong. It's up to humans to decide how to act. Sin, therefore, is a choice to act badly. This is important in two ways. The first is that it is in direct opposition to the Augustinian formulation, which became orthodoxy. St. Augustine of Hippo, a different St. Augustine to the one who converted Britain, well, he argued that humans are born with the mark of Adam, i.e. that we are all born sinful and it is only by God's grace that we are saved. As you might have told by my tone, I really like Pelagius' formulation of Christianity. What's especially interesting about Pelagianism is that it had links to pagan beliefs. Pelagius took a much more positive view of human nature, and he followed many classical philosophers in putting the burden of human improvement on the human and not on grace. This meant that babies who died unbaptized went to heaven. They were pure. It also meant that humans had to take responsibility for their actions, which, if you're able to cast your mind all the way back to our discussion of Lindo Man, is not unrelated from many of the ideas we have of Celtic beliefs. The idea that, in the words of Russell Crowe in Gladiator, what we do in life echoes in eternity. Pelagianism was a way for many in Roman Britain to profess a connection to the Christian God while keeping hold of the lifestyle born of their pagan beliefs. It hints at Britain that still got more from their traditional pagan beliefs than the newfangled, dualistic and monotheistic Christianity. What Christianity did give was a way for the elites to express their connection to the Roman Empire, which was used, especially in West Britain, to justify a new form of elite control after the Romans left. It was also used by the elites in Roman Britain to express that they had the right belief, the up-to-date belief, the one that gave them access to the halls of power. A bit like how all the Hollywood celebrities are always a good bellwether for the political views of the American elite. Actually, I think this gives us an opportunity to visit Yorkshire, always a good thing, and get a flavour of how the elites used Roman identity to express their status. It will also give us a flavour of what life was like in the late Roman Empire. A nice bookend to the early Roman Britain we visited at the start of the show. Let's visit the Lady of York. We started in the south of England, in Londinium, sailing up the River Thames. Put on your coat, wrap a scarf around your neck. We're heading down the Humber, then up the River Ouse to Eboracum. York, where God lives. This is a city with a long history, and its excellent river routes have made it a centre for trade and immigration since its foundation by the Romans in 71 CE, when the local tribe, called the Bagrantes, started to make trouble. We know this because of the epigraphic evidence. Epigraphy is one of the fancy Greek-sounding names which would be much better in proper Anglo-Saxon. Epigraphy means stone writing, or inscription into rock. In York, we have these inscriptions telling us that in Roman York were Gauls, Italians, and even one Egyptian. Traditionally, these have been seen as evidence of legionaries coming into York, finding a nice local girl to settle down with, and making their home in Rome's most northerly outpost. Like a lot of traditional ideas, especially many of the pervasive ones that won't go away, it relies on ignoring a lot of information. This theory relies on ignoring a burial discovered in 1901, so, you know, well before many of these theories were even being popularised. She is nicknamed the Ivory Bangle Lady, which hints at the richness of her tomb. She is buried in a stone coffin which is aligned north-south. Her head is looking northwards. Her grave goods are at once restrained and fabulously wealthy, fitting with the fact she was clearly a wealthy woman who died in the mid-300s, when the Roman elites were, as we discussed, becoming or acting at least in a predominantly Christian manner. On her grave is the inscription, "Hail, sister, may you live in God," except, you know, it's in Latin. On her arms are the bangles suggested by her name. Of course, some of them are ivory, probably from African elephants. Others, though, are from Whitby Jet, which is only a 40-minute car drive from York. One of her bangles is made from blue glass beads, not bluegrass beads. She's wearing other jewellery too. She has earrings and a pendant on a beaded necklace. Next to her rests a blue glass jug and a glass mirror, maybe it hinting at some earlier pagan traditions being carried with her into a Christian faith. This is a wealthy burial. Glass and a stone tomb are clear indicators, and her ivory bangles are very rare in Roman Britain. It also speaks, perhaps, to her heritage. You see, some archaeologists use phrenology. That's right, the study of skulls. Except, they don't use phrenology to make statements about people's personality or how close they're related to apes. Phrenology, the study of the morphology of the face and skull, can be used to create statistical probabilities of someone's heritage. Obviously, potentially terrifying when used incorrectly. However, if you combine phrenology with DNA and stable isotope analysis, you can begin to build a picture of where someone came from. You see, this lady's skull is statistically similar to those of black Africans, while her face has some more European features, which initially suggested she might be of mixed race or from North Africa. And we know there were definitely North Africans living in York in the 300s from the epigraphs we just discussed. I haven't found any DNA results from the ivory bangle lady, but there has been some stable isotope analysis completed. I'm not going to go into detail on what SIA is again, as we've done that a few times before, but it's a way to look at the chemical ratios in bones and teeth and use that to create predictions on where someone may be from. Check out the episode on the Avery Archer for the full lowdown. This stable isotope analysis shows she grew up on the coast of southern Europe or North Africa. Based on the relative statistics of both her phrenology and stable isotopes, as well as what we know from the epigraphic and documentary evidence, we think this ivory bangle lady was a wealthy woman, originally from Egypt and probably of mixed ancestry, which would fit, as the Egyptian elites at this time were a mix of the native Egyptian population and the Greeks who took over the country after Alexander's death. This summarises a lot of what we've been speaking about this episode. First of all, it shows how archaeology can be used as a tightrope upon which to discuss some important but politically loaded areas, such as ancestry, heritage, human morphology, and, oddly, phrenology, which is not where I thought this episode would go. Seriously, I had no idea this was an archaeological technique until I researched this episode, and I think that's brilliant. I'm learning with you. The drum of archaeology's real-world relevance is one I'm going to beat a lot this season. However, this lady captures other things we've learned today. She shows that the Roman Britain was globalised and diverse. It was a world which took in folks with complex and composite heritages and life stories and allowed them to create ever more complex and composite life stories here in Britain. That level of integration allowed a woman from North Africa to live, love and die in Northern Britain. It was also a rich world, full of inequalities. Do you know why her tomb was remarkable? Because it is clearly much wealthier than the many that were found near it, even though the dig was in a richer area of a Roman cemetery. Yes, the Romans did a lot for the world, but they have a lot to answer for. Roman Britain was a complex one with a complex legacy. It was also clearly an unstable one, especially after the Antonine Plague and the crisis of the 3rd century. Security never fully returned to Rome, and especially not to its farther reaches, away from the safety of imperial field armies crossing the central continent. Within half a century of this lady's death, Britain wasn't Roman anymore. Instead, it was an even more complex and composite world than the one we've sketched out in this episode. Let's wrap up today's show and create a platform to jump into the post-Roman debate. So what do you think? Was Rome a good thing for Britain? I think your answer points towards your view of civilization in general. Dan Carlin, I think it was Dan Carlin, I might be wrong, talked about this idea between how you judge the greatness of a civilization. Do you look at its peak score, or do you look at its average score? This will be an easier comparison for my fellow Age of Empires or Civilization players. Does a civilization win by building unique structures like Greece's Parthenon, the Roman Colosseum, the Cambodian Angkor Wat, or any other world wonder? Does a civilization win by controlling more land and more people than ever before, like 19th century Britain or medieval Mongolia? I.e., does a civilization become great by focusing its resources on reaching new heights, such as greater buildings, more wealth, or larger territories? Or does a civilization win by reducing inequality and making the lives of its people better? Does one matter more than the other? Or do you need a combination of both or neither? Is comparing and rating civilizations a fool errand for folks too fond of video games? Let me know what you think. Whether Rome was good also says something about your view of the modern world. Do you want a globalized world, dominated by a rich elite, but one which undoubtedly brings progress? Or are you skeptical of narratives of progress when those who aren't on the same road find their lives becoming monotonous, short, and limited? Or are you like your typically academic host, who refuses to take a side in anything and doesn't understand why there can't be a third way, with progress that doesn't disappoint and doesn't abandon? Let me know where in this ongoing and important debate you find yourself. Let me know what you think of this episode. There'll be another one next month, where we head up north to Hadrian's Wall to talk about the world after the Romans properly left. Why does all of this matter? Rome left Britain. And I'm not sure some Brits have ever really forgiven Rome for doing so. Rome didn't leave Gaul, Hispania, North Africa, Greece, Turkey, or Egypt. In Gaul, when Germans arrived, they blended with an existing Latin government structure. The reason the French speak French is because when the Franks became dominant, they adopted many things, including the language. The same story is true in North Africa, where the Vandals adopted Roman culture, as in Spain, Italy, and all across the Roman Empire. But not Britain. Britain was decidedly not Roman, even by the time the Emperor Honorius effectively gave up on the island in 410. The fact Rome left Britain meant that Britain developed differently to the rest of the continent in ways that are still affecting the world today. It set Britain on a different course, a course we're going to spend the rest of this season exploring. Nobody's as excited as I am. If you are, join the Patreon, follow on Facebook or Instagram. We've just passed 500 followers, and I'm far more active than previously. In the meantime, mask up, register to vote if you're in a modern Rome, the USA. Stay safe and stay warm. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and this is All Bones. See you soon.